playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Monaghan was Big Tom country, and so it was that Big Tom McBride was laid to rest beside his beloved wife Rose in his home village of Oram, outside Castleblayney yesterday. There was no talk of an urban-rural divide as hundreds of fans and friends from near and far turned out to say a final farewell to the King of Country, the humble, gentle giant whom President Higgins described as one of the most charismatic and influential artists in Irish country music.
Four country roads winding to a town in County Galway. Four country roads leading to the friends I left behind. Four dusty roads winding to the town of Glenmady. Four dusty roads forever in the caverns of my mind. Once in a while I hear the sound of music in the winter night. I see now and then the trees where we sheltered from the rain. In a while I see us walking home in the morning light. And after the time I long to see my hometown once again. Four roads from Glenmady, four roads that drift apart.
There was obvious shock when news broke of Big Tom's death on Tuesday morning. Although he was 81 and broken-hearted since the death of Rose 11 weeks ago, few realised he was as ill as he was. And across the RTE radio schedule, from Morning Ireland to Late Date, there were tributes to him. On the Ryan Tuberty Show, the stars lined up to pay homage.
I mean, I grew up, obviously, you know, all through Big Tom's career. And, you know, he was from just the era of the huge country music stars in Ireland. And he was the pillar. We all refer to him as the king. He reached out, you know, to people in Ireland and those people who had emigrated from Ireland in the days when, you know, so many people lived in England and their whole connection with Ireland was the bands on the weekend and the National and the Forum and the Galtymore and all the dances around London and Manchester and Birmingham. And just he was such a connection. And his music, there was something about his music. As late as last September, you know, we did the Opry, and he was a guest on the Opry, and he did the show himself, and Rose was there, and it was such a terrific night, you know, that he was able to do that show. And then when the Flood concert was in Letterkenny, mm-hmm. he came along, you know, and he was terrific. And I suppose he just was so much to people and so much to the country music singers in Ireland. Big Tom was the one that everybody seen as the main man.
Daniel O'Donnell. Well, Daniel's sister Margot first met Tom in 1966 and they were close friends.
He had the common touch, you know, he really did. And neighbours could come to him for anything, Ryan. I swear to God, I mean, he has tractors out there. And he used to give the tractors to the neighbours to do the work. I've recorded with many, many people, Ryan, even Dolly. But I never, ever was as proud as the day that Tom and I recorded together. And this morning, Ryan, my heart is broken. But the only thing that I'm happy about is that he's with Rose. Yeah. And this was a love affair. I mean, I spend most days with them. You know, I have a statue being erected to him in September. And we were rehearsing songs for a CD that he was bringing out. So I spent an awful lot of time with both of them. And I sometimes the love was so clear that I used to say to them, "Will you just get a room?" You know, because it was just. And I know, Ryan, that whatever's after this life, I know that Rose has taken Tom with her. He wasn't happy. I went out and he was in his bed after the funeral and he was lying on his side. And I don't think I'll ever forget it. And he looked up at me and he said to me, "Margot, the boss is gone." You know, and that's all he wanted, to be with Rose.
The Queen of Country, Philomena Begley, recalled the glory days of the showband scene in the 60s and 70s and praised Big Tom's knack at picking the hit songs, songs about real experiences that people could relate to.
He was a character in his own right, and, you know, when if he came into the room, you know, we would light up the room there, you know, because it'd be full of devilment too, you know, and we always had great conversations with him and that. The last time I was speaking to him, I think it was at the Roscommon race course last year, and he told me himself that he wasn't feeling that good. But I never, to be honest, never realised it, that it got to the stage that it is.
I know it's early hours to be talking about the legacy, musical and otherwise, of Big Tom.
The one thing Big Tom had when he started to sing, he had a fantastic beat for anybody who wanted to dance. I used to always say, if you couldn't dance to Big Tom, you just couldn't dance. Because every song that he recorded, there's meaning to it, and, you know, Gentle Mother and Lonesome at Your Table and Four Roads to Glenamattie. And there's so many songs that, you know, that you can relate to Big Tom with. And again, in saying that, it's, you know, he was a great, great band to dance to.
Of course, we met him a couple of times on the Late Late Show in the last couple of years for the country special. He made it, despite his, particularly last year, his health wasn't in great form. His presence, and you've alluded to it,
No matter when he walked into the room there, you know, he was always in good form and he enjoyed the crack, you know, when he got in amongst all the people in the music business, as we all do.
Well, Big Tom wasn't just a massive crowd magnet on both sides of the border in this country. He also travelled by ferry to England with his band, packing them in the dance halls of Birmingham, Manchester and London, bringing his distinctive country and Irish sound to meccas like the Galtymore, the National, the Forum, as you've heard, comforting the emigrant communities of Cricklewood, Kilburn, Camden, Willesden, with stories of home, as Declan Nerney explained.
He was the root of what country music was all about, particularly in the selection of songs that he himself recorded and, you know, all the great hits down the years. And, you know, it always came back to us. And the people who bought into Big Tom's style of music or you know, it was like a religion in a way, because they lived their lives by the songs, and particularly the immigrants away, people in London and Manchester and Birmingham and further afield, New York and all, they looked very much forward to it, and it was like a piece of Irishness that they held on to and they got great gratification and satisfaction from, and comfort more than anything else. And he reminded them of home. He was home. He was part of the culture of an invisibleness that can't be described.
Over the past 40 years, Patrick McFadden regularly booked Big Tom and the Mainliners to play the Glencairn Hotel in Castleblayney, a hotbed of country music. But he too was a big fan for years before that, and he recalled sneaking out to a dance hall in Donegal as a teenager, a hall which only held 900, clearly too small for the crowds that wanted to see Big Tom in action.
The hall would have held probably about 800 or 900 people, but there was 2,000 people outside who couldn't get in, and the local guard came along, and this was long before health and safety became an issue, and demanded that all the exit doors be opened, and the whole car park became a dance hall. That's my first encounter with Tom, but I've been a friend of his for well over 30 years.
You went on to become the managing director of the Glencairn Hotel in Castleblayney.
That is correct, yeah.
What were Big Tom nights like?
Big Tom nights were, you couldn't find a word to describe it. The atmosphere was absolutely electric. Once the gig would be booked, every room would be booked up in both hotels and bed and breakfast within a 20-mile radius. People would travel from Cork, Kerry, Mayo, you name it. The atmosphere and the build-up, as I said, to the big night, and it was a hometown gig for Tom, and people loved going to it. The last one that I remember that he did was in 2015, and I would say, which was 1,500 people had attended that night. You see on television fans standing at the stage. Well, that was the uniqueness of Tom. There'd be 15, 20 deep at the stage, just standing, just hoping to get a chance to get a touch of his hand or just to get a photograph with him.
Father Brian Darcy was another close friend for over 50 years.
He was the gentleman. He was the king of country music. He was the one that everybody looked up to. He was the one that probably the elitists sort of looked down their noses at, and Big Tom outlasted them all. And his last gig, he was able to bring 1,000 people into his show who still adored the ground he walked on, who still loved him as a friend and as a singer, who still appreciated what he had done for them, who still made their hearts want to dance every time he opened his mouth and sang. Tom was one of them, but he was their king as well. He invented the term country and Irish music, really. He was the one who had them dancing thousands and thousands and thousands every night of the week. He went to England. He held the record in Galtymore. And he was there the last night that it was closed. And he told me one time, the saddest night in his life, I'm sure that was until Rose died, the saddest night in his life was the night that he played at the closing of the Galtymore in London, because that special message that Tom was able to bring to emigrants ended that night, and an era ended. And today, an industry has ended with the death of the King, Big Tom.
Father Brian Darcy. Well, as I've mentioned, Big Tom's funeral mass was celebrated in St Patrick's Church in Oram yesterday. RTE's Kieran Mullooly was there, and he reported live into the News at One with Christopher McEvitt.
Kieran, a sad day, of course, for all who knew Big Tom and the many who enjoyed his music. But how was he celebrated today?
Christopher, a sad day, but an extraordinary celebration of the lifetime of Big Tom McBride. From early morning, the crowds have gathered here at St Patrick's Church in Orm with hundreds of people from around the country and indeed abroad, alongside his colleagues from the Irish country music scene. Icons themselves, such as Daniel O'Donnell, Philomena Begley, Dickie Rock, all of those names here today. Last night, of course, President Michael D. Higgins was in the McBride homestead. He was there to sympathise with the family. And today, Big Tom's remains were brought to the church with the jersey of his favourite and beloved Orem GA club on the top of that coffin. So we had the mixture then of the sombre and the serene in the church, Christopher, and what could only be described as the celebration and the jamboree that followed outside. A most extraordinary send-off, as I say. At the end of that ceremony, after Father Leo had completed, the church cleared out, Big Tom's remains brought to the cemetery nearby, and as soon as the prayers were over, a local man here in the area, Jim O'Neill, spoke with a moving oration, followed by a concert. You might even be able to hear it in the distance at the moment. For about half an hour, the top performers of country music in Ireland all stepped forward to the microphone at the cemetery, and we heard them all. Daniel O'Donnell, Philomena Begley, Susan McCann, and the mainliners themselves came back to sing a very emotional rendition of the famous song Gentle Mother that, of course, made the band in the first place. And, you know, it's quite surreal watching it over the last while. I'm sure the big man himself would have enjoyed it. In the brilliant sunshine overlooking the Drumlin Hills here in Monaghan, we have the sight of the singing, the music, and the people jiving around the grave of Tom McBride. What an incredible celebration to mark the end of an incredible life.
RTE's Midlands correspondent Kieran Mullooly reporting from Monaghan.
I visualise the hedgerows on the road I used to go. I see the town of Blaney and the lakes of Lochmacknow. Around the old Hope Castle, where so often I would roam, I dream of Castle Blaney, my old people and my home. The harbour lights are fading as I leave this foreign shore, and I watch the dark horizon that I mean to see no more. Hear the land that holds the legend of the fairy and the gnome. Going back to Castle Blaney, my old people and my home. Back to Castle Blaney, my old people and my home.
Ireland's answer to Johnny Cash, the late Big Tom McBride. Well, his legacy was also discussed in the Dáil.
Gentle Mother, that was my favourite song.
Hello, Deputy McDonald.
With respect, Taoiseach, yeah? If anyone in this house can lay claim to the country and western hinterland of the border regions, then it is the Sinn Féin Party.
Well, hello, Mary Lou.
Exactly, yeah?
Concordo, we're losing focus on the substantive issue here in terms of surely the serious questions that Minister Dennis Nocton has to answer going forward.
Taoiseach is obfuscating.
The minister is dancing on the head of a pin here.
Let's not be hasty, Deputy Dooley. After all, nobody wants to collapse the government ahead of a vitally important referendum that nobody else wants to have to bring to the electorate going forward in terms of...
It's hard for Edgar's fault.
That's more like it now. Yes, it's hard to dissolve the teacher's fault going forward.
Hello, Deputy Breed Cappinger, People Against Progress.
This is typical of the bourgeois laissez-faire, big wig, fat cat, petty valoo, corporate
Deputy, are we still talking about Big Tom?
Sorry, nobody holds the importance of an independent news and media in higher regard than I do. Agenda-setting journalists of the calibre of Barry Egan. Incidentally, look out for my photo shoot on 6 gym workouts to put the guns back into Irish politics next week. Right, Big Tom forever. Teach out.
On a point of order, Can Corla, can we hold the rest of the class outside in the sunshine?
Yes, we can, Mary Lou. No running. Stop them. Don't be pulling their hair. Hey, lads, is someone drinking in the chamber?
From Callan's Kicks last night. Well, that controversy surrounding Minister Dennis Nocton's phone call with the lobbyist Onan Yachtan 2 years ago about the proposed takeover of Celtic Media by Independent News and Media was a topic on The Gathering this week. On Sean O'Rourke's panel, TDs Noel Rock and Richard Boyd Barrett and journalists Alison O'Connor and Michael O'Regan.
First of all, he should have said either not taken the call or should have said, I can't say anything to you,
yeah,
right?
I cannot
say anything to you because you have an interest in this process.
Alison O'Connor, are the opposition going through the motions, or in fact in this case not going through the motions, in their criticism of Dennis Nocton?
The opposition are going through the motions. The thing is that they're not bringing it up to the next level. And I mean, I think it's risible to hear Noel, and I heard Peter Burke on Primetime last night, this whole idea, oh, but we weren't in the process then, the statutory process. That's a nonsense. You know, the question you have to ask yourself is, are you comfortable with the idea of a lobbyist ringing a minister and getting an inside track on what is effectively related to a multi-million euro deal and has all sorts of corporate implications? Personally, I'm not.
But hang on,
agree with Richard. It's a major mistake, but I think that Dennis Nocton has a lot in his favour in that he's well liked, he's respected as a minister, former Fine Gael. I'd say they're even thinking if they're nice to him now, who knows what might happen down the line. And nobody in Leinster House wants an election at the moment. So all of those things, certainly Sinn Féin may try and lengthen his discomfort. I think that's very interesting because all along, when you look at the bigger picture here and Dennis O'Brien's control of Irish media, the politicians, Fine Gael in particular, would rather eat their own toenails than confront this. But in this particular instance, it's now been really put up to them and they have to. But Sinn Féin have very little to lose because traditionally independent news and media have taken an anti-Sinn Féin stance. And I have found it very interesting just as an observer in the last year or two to see that has really been ratcheted up. So I'd say the Shinners feel they've nothing to lose.
Michael O'Regan, we did, and even though he says he doesn't talk about contemporary politics, Brian Cowan did manage to say that he doesn't regard Dennis Nocton's position as untenable.
And that would be a view privately held in Leinster House by a significant number of opposition people. But, now, it was an error of judgment on the minister's part. It looks terrible. A lobbyist on behalf of a powerful media company ringing a minister to get information on his mobile phone. I think from now on, by the way, no politician will take a call from a lobbyist. But Brian Cowan was right. It's not a resigning issue. The minister handled it badly.
From the Today Show yesterday. Last Saturday was a good day for jockey Davy Russell as he led Tiger Roll to victory in the Grand National at Aintree in a heart-stopping finish. The winning horse is owned by Michael O'Leary, and following the race, Bezzy mates Davy and Michael hopped on a Ryanair flight where a thrilled Michael O'Leary grabbed the in-flight microphone and addressed their fellow passengers.
Very sorry, I want to apologise personally for the 10-minute delay in our departure. This is because we had to bring the Grand National winning jockey, yeah, Davy Russell. It's an important ride he gave us tomorrow in Tremor, but as you know, it was the day we won the Grand National, so unusually on board this flight, there's going to be a free bar. We which I am personally going to pay for. But you're all restricted to one free drink only. We're not giving two drinks out, okay? So free bar, and we may have to do a circle over Dublin just to get it all done. Thank you very much, and apologies again for the delay.
Ryanair boss Michael O'Leary. Well, the following morning, the winning jockey joined Miriam O'Callaghan to talk about the race, a race he always dreamt of winning as a boy.
Every young lad with a pony dreams of winning the Grand National, and I've done it so many times. Like, Dad cuts the grass at home, and as a child, and we pick it up and you make the green fences and you go around. And I can remember, you know, riding up and down the beach in Yall the day of the Grand National when I was younger and pretending that I was in it. You know what I mean? It's just one of them races that it captures, no matter what part of the equestrian world, everybody wants a piece of it. You know what I mean? It's just a fascinating race, really. It just really captures the imagination.
And everyone's written, Davy, about Tiger Roll, your horse, this diminutive gelding with the heart of a lion. They keep saying he's the smallest horse there. Tell me about the horse.
I won a festival race at Cheltenham on him 4 years ago, and he was probably bred for the flat. He wasn't maybe as tall as other horses, but he had a great physique to him. He was really strong in stature, and he had great movement to his body, and Jigginstown bought him and sent him to Gordon. And yeah, he just was bought as a hurdler, we'll say, because he was that little bit smaller, but he looked sharp and fast. You know, he went to Gordon's, and he was a really good hurdler. Then Gordon decided to throw his hand at chasing with him, and he showed an awful lot of stamina for a horse that looked like he was quick. You know, it just went on from there. He won a couple of, you know, good handicap chases, and he won a race at the festival again. Gordon had decided at that stage that he would suit the national course, and that he'd take his chance. That was basically it. Just, he's a really kind horse. He's a good looking horse. He's a pretty lad, but he's just not big and tall and angler like. Some people imagine that a big chase, a big horse to win the Grand National comes as a big, solid unit, but Tiger Roll is small and classy.
You were nearly pipped to the post. What did you think at that moment? Did you think you'd lost it or not?
I saw an awful lot of the horse, we'll say, going by me. Usually when that happens, you can be done on the line, but luckily enough, it was literally on the line. I just held on, and David's horse, Pleasant Company, flashed by me at the line, but I wasn't sure, because I wasn't really sure where the line was, if you know what I mean. I just had my head down, driving away, and I was worried whether he had just nailed me on the line, you know.
Grand National winning jockey Davy Russell heard on Sunday with Miriam. The other big sports story, of course, was the news that Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger will leave the club at the end of the season after 22 long years, and many Arsenal fans can't wait to see the back of him. Ken Early of the Second Captain's podcast assessed his legacy on the Today Show yesterday.
22 years in charge, 3 Premier League titles, 7 FA Cups, quite the record. But I suppose his problem really was that those successes, to borrow the phrase from business, that were kind of front loaded.
Yes, he's got a eaten bread is soon forgotten problem. It's a long time since they won the Premier League. I mean, it's 14 years. To go 14 years is actually quite a long time in Arsenal terms. I mean, the thing is that when he took over Arsenal, they were the second most successful club in English football. They're now the third most successful. I mean, he leaves them a very rich club in a new stadium. They're the biggest club in the biggest city in the UK. But that was all true when he took over in 1996. I mean, when he took over, they'd finished fifth in the league the season before, 19 points behind the champions. And now they're sixth in the league, sort of 33 points behind the champions and counting. So, I mean, I'd say if he had left this job 10 years ago, he would have said, well, he's revolutionised the club. He's brought them forward. They've evolved. It's been a quantum leap under the management of Arsene Wenger. And now it's kind of, well, they're sort of in the same kind of place as they were when he took over. It's come full circle. What he did do is transform the outlook and the culture of the club. I mean, it's true to say that English football generally has become much more internationalised, much more outward-looking than it was in the mid-1990s. But Arsenal in particular, he was kind of the originator of the, you know, he proved that, you know, a French manager could come to England and succeed, you know, with a team largely made of foreign players. You know, this was kind of a, you'll never win in English football with a bunch of foreigners. He proved that, in fact, you could. He showed a kind of a new way to play, a new way of winning. And it's, I suppose, ironic for him in a sense that he stopped being successful when everybody else started to use the methods that he had employed to such a devastating effect in his first few years.
Ken Early of Second Captains with Sean O'Rourke. In its latest report released on Tuesday, Women's Aid revealed that 19,000 women and children had contacted the organisation to report domestic abuse, both physical and emotional. Over on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan spoke with Yorkshire woman Claire Throssell, whose life was destroyed by her husband's coercive and controlling behaviour.
He was very charming, sort of romantic. He sent a rose every day to my works until I agreed to go out with him. And then after that, he just turned into a complete monster.
At what point did you feel, Claire, this guy isn't quite what I had hoped he might be?
You know, it starts very slowly. It kind of drips into the relationship. I think it was after Jack was born, and I used to get about 40 phone calls a day from him asking where I was, what I was doing. I was stalked within the marriage, basically, and he was jealous of the boys, put me down, and that really was the turning point of the relationship.
They were married for 16 years before Claire finally decided she was leaving for good in 2014. And despite Claire's warning to social services and the courts about her husband's behaviour, he still had 5 hours unsupervised access to their two children, Jack, aged 12, and Paul, who was 9. On the morning of Wednesday, the 22nd of October, the boys were due to see their father after school. He'd promised to take them to his house where they could play with the new train set he'd assembled in the attic.
When he picked the boys up, he put a bowl of sweets up in the attic, and the boys had gone straight up to the attic. And while they were up there, my ex-husband set 14 individual fires, barricaded the home, barricaded the kitchen, and made sure that not only could anybody get in, but the boys would never be able to get out either. And then he set the fires and went up to the attic. Jack tried to get his brother out. He tried to save his brother. He could have run away, but he didn't. He stayed. And it cuts me in two to know that Paul felt Jack's hands last, not mine. And it was Jack's strength that pulled him to the edge of the hatch where the attic opened, not me. And he unfortunately fell through into the flames. And as he lay there on the floor and the fireman cradled him so gently, Jack used his courage and he said to the fireman, "My dad did this and he did it on purpose." And they took those words as my son's dying testimony. And he also told the fireman and the doctor in the hospital before they actually sedated him and he fell asleep. He never knew that Paul fell asleep first because he fought for 5 days. But he never knew that Paul didn't make it.
Claire has been campaigning for almost 4 years now on behalf of domestic abuse victims and has called for a change in the law governing access to children in the UK.
What is your chief mission in life now, Claire? What would you like to achieve?
I want to raise awareness of emotional control and coercive control. I want people to talk about it and not just brush it under the carpet. Mm. Our Prime Minister said for too many years and too many governments, it's been put to one side, it's been brushed under the carpet. It's no discriminator of society, rank. It happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. And if people talk about it and admit that there are problems, then maybe, just maybe, a child won't have to go through what Jack went through. And no child will have to say to an emergency service person that my dad or my mum did this and they did it on purpose.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Monday. And if you've been affected by Claire's story, you can contact Women's Aid Ireland on 1800 341 900. That's 1800 341 900. And it's a 24-hour free phone helpline. With less than 5 weeks to go to the referendum on whether or not to remove Article 43.3 from the Constitution, many parents around the country are struggling to explain to their children in an age-appropriate way what exactly the issues are on both sides of the argument. Owen Murphy rang Joe on the live line on Monday. Himself and his wife planned to talk to their 10-year-old son about the topic last Sunday, but first they wanted to attend his mother-in-law's anniversary mass in Carlow Cathedral.
Went through the usual welcomes and so on, and then announced that there would be a doctor who would be speaking on behalf of the pro-life campaign with regard to the referendum. Mm-hmm. So that put myself and my wife in an immediate awkward position where we had had a conversation. Obviously, at 10 years of age, he's like a sponge. His younger brother is 8. Things can kind of go over his head at the older brother's spots. But we had had a conversation about what way we were going to handle it. So our plan was to go to the anniversary mass and then have a chat, what we would deem an age-appropriate chat, and inform our son as to the extent that we wanted to about what was happening. And just, look, he is what I would regard as a worrier. You know, he can see things and then think about them and come to us with stuff. So we just wanted to kind of be proactive about that before he saw something or heard something that was on his mind. So after the gospel, the priest then introduced the doctor. And at that point, I stood up, my wife stood up, and we said to our son, we're going to go outside for a little while. We got outside and he asked, how come we're coming out? And, you know, he was basically there for his granny's anniversary now, okay. So he had no idea what was happening. We ended up having the conversation that we had planned to have with him out at the side of the cathedral.
Are people genuinely surprised that the Catholic Church, who have a very strong position?
I certainly wasn't surprised of their position. What I was surprised was their handling of it.
You were essentially taking your child outside because you wanted to have the conversation in your own terms.
We were absolutely making a particular environment. We felt that was a conversation we wanted to have.
So you went back into the church, and what happened when it came to the sign of peace?
So we went back in, and very quickly after that, it came to the sign of peace, and we had taken back the positions we had been in.
Yeah.
So there was two women in the seat alongside me, and I turned to give the sign of peace. And they kind of looked at each other hurriedly and immediately knelt down and ignored me, basically refused to shake my hand.
Owen Murphy and Carlo. Well, Brendan O'Regan also rang Joe in response to another caller, Noel, who'd objected to what he called the graphic posters being displayed by the pro-life campaign.
I've seen hundreds of posters and I haven't seen any that are graphic yet. Anywhere there are pictures of babies, it's unborn babies that are alive. So I certainly wouldn't agree that they're graphic.
I think Noel went on to say it was the word surrounding them.
Yeah, and he said something like, would you murder this baby? Now, I certainly haven't seen a poster like that. And I just wonder, are people jumping to conclusions? I certainly haven't seen a poster with that kind of a slogan on it.
Mm. Is the word license to kill?
That's, I think, on some of the posters.
Yeah. Well, is that not... With the photograph and the word, is that not... That, I think that's what Noel found upsetting.
Look, some people might find that over the top. It's what kind of puzzled me a little bit in a way is people taking offence at the posters but not expressing offence at the reality of abortion that they're trying to get across. I think there's a bit of a contradiction there. And all the sort of issues raised here seem to be against the pro-life side of the argument, and there's an awful lot of offence one could take at some of the stuff the repealers are up to in terms of using religious imagery or sort of making ageist comments on Twitter and that kind of thing is pretty gross.
The ageist comments, what are you referring to there?
People, there was a picture posted on Twitter of people at a pro-life meeting, and it just happened that a lot of the people in that angle of the picture were, let's say, they weren't young, and there was an awful amount of vicious comments about them afterwards and on Twitter calling them dust bags, and that's only some of the milder.
Mm. And what was the other issue on the yes side? So some of the religious imagery, where is that?
Yeah, they had back, they were putting repeal jumpers on religious, what do you call it, grottos, that kind of thing. Somebody used a graphic of a repeal poster plonked over a picture of the Virgin Mary and so on. I think that was rather insensitive, but it didn't seem to cause the same level of offence.
And who was we don't know who was doing that, do we?
Not.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Monday. The tattooed numbers on the forearms of prisoners in Auschwitz are one of the most stark and dehumanising symbols of the Holocaust. Heather Morris's book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, tells the story of Lali Sokolov, who was born to Jewish parents. In April 1942, at the age of 26, he was taken to the Nazi death camp, where instead of being executed, he was selected for forced labour.
What a ghoulish job. Yeah. I've met a couple of survivors of Auschwitz, and one of the first things they do is they pull up their sleeve and they say, look at this, lest we forget. And it was possibly Lali, the man you were talking to, this octogenarian gentleman with his dogs, who put that tattoo on their arms. Can you tell me how he ended up with that job?
Well, he actually should have died. He had typhoid. He got typhoid within weeks of arriving there. And one of the young men in his block was dragging him off the death cart when a stranger came by and helped him. He hovered between that life and death as the prisoners in his block smuggled in small amounts of the food. And look, heaven knows that what they got was barely subsistence, but they kept him alive during the night And during the day, this stranger was coming to see him. And when that stranger came and took him outside when he was just strong enough to walk, he introduced himself as Pepan, the Tatavera. So he had that role. And he suggested to Lully that if he worked for him, he may be able to survive a little longer because he was too weak to go back working on the construction. And he ended up taking the role, and within a matter of only a few weeks, he turned up to work and Pepan wasn't there. And the camp commandant, Hustik, who was in charge of selections, just pointed to Lully and said, "You are now the Tatavera."
You are now the tattooist of Auschwitz.
Yes.
And this strange role that he had to, no doubt, have a moral, an epic moral battle with himself as a Jewish man to tattoo the endless trains of people from around Europe with these numbers. He had to keep doing it. And that brings us to July 1942, when he's tattooing all these people, and then this one woman out of all of them stops him in his tracks.
Absolutely. I mean, here's our man about our town, our playboy, and he has got a young girl standing in front of him with her head shaven, dressed in rags. And the moment he thought she was going to speak, he squeezed her arm to attract her attention to shush her. And he did. And in that moment, he told me 6 years later, their eyes met and he knew that he would never love another. He had met Geeta. He just didn't know who she was yet.
Just some of the stories from Heather Morris's book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, heard on The Tubridy Show on Tuesday. On last Sunday's poetry programme, Olivia O'Leary was joined by Irish language poet Louis Dupuyer and bilingual poet Dhiren Ní Gcríofa. Louis had shied away in the past from making references to folklore or mythology in his work, but an encounter in Australia changed his mind.
I come from an English-speaking background in the suburbs of Cork, and I always felt wary of using anything from folklore or mythology. I never felt I was really entitled to use that material. But I was in Melbourne one day, and a fishmonger at the Victoria Market started talking to me, and he said, "Do you know about this character called Cú Chulainn?" And I said, "I do, yeah, great hero in Irish mythology." I said, "Why are you always interested?" And he says, "Oh, I call my son Cú Chulainn." And I said, "You can't be serious. You can't call a kid Cú Chulainn." And he says, "Well, actually," he said, "I'm telling a lie, the wife didn't like it, so," he said, "I dogged it, and Cú Chulainn is the child's second name." And I said, "So what's the kid's first name?" He says, "He's called Trevor Cú Chulainn." So I explained that that was really not the way it was supposed to work. But what I thought, while I was away from Ireland, it became clear to me that everything is available to all of us and we're all entitled to everything.
You were in Australia for quite a few years.
Yeah, so this is the first poem in which I ever made a reference to mythology, and Cú Chulainn's Hurley gets a run out here. Nur vientu as baile geirian banya uur sa chishnoir doan an tostu ig hain balavian an gahan is kailtar fara fwish der a thli chan an tí Crinian Mormonic is fine he Jehovah and minister son sagart peroshta ban evan is fair amwe le chael er lican dorish chon manam damanta a ghamanu nietach batman me a thlanu. Plodian shkilahori is murderori muirfracht is kigri conach sa chlos a plonker of winog iata is shkehe maroon os ard lish na corsan chuleishtacha ni churin ma facui curula na ma churina pacula eanuntas er eania. Derhucht, vata, valav, istig, foshkim de churach das brailin ur, kurdin kaman chu chulling, fin docht, riestruch, knapanach. When you're not here, the milk turns sour in the fridge, the toaster burns the last piece of bread deliberately, the phone is struck dumb, and the postman dies on his way to the house. Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, the minister and the parish priest, the Avon lady and the Amway man gang outside my door to lambast my blasted soul. Even Batman couldn't save me. Terrorists and murderers, clampers and tax inspectors crowd the backyard, pounding on locked windows, yelling my secrets at the top of their voices for the benefit of eavesdropping neighbours. My criminal sins and sinful crimes are a surprise to no one. In the cowering, dumb, dark inside, I hug your scent from cold sheets. I reach for Cú Chulainn's Hurley under the battle-furious, lumpy mattress.
Trevor Cú Chulainn, you never know, it might start a trend. Louis Dupuyer there from last Sunday's poetry programme, and the series continues tomorrow evening at 7:30 when Olivia's guest is Yvan Boland. Crystal ball gazing is always fun, especially when the impact these predicted advances will have on our lives is truly transformational. Well, on the business, Richard Curran went into full-on Jetsons mode with intelligent mobility expert John McCarthy on the topic of driverless cars. John believes that Ireland stands to make a killing if we can foster the industries that create the high-tech machinery these robot cars will need.
You have projected forward based on the technology that exists today and where that technology is going to go around self-driving vehicles. And I think in the report you suggested that by 2040, something like 70 or 75% of the vehicles on the road would be machine-driven. Is that realistic?
I think it is realistic, and I'll take that timeline closer to today. By 2021, all of the car manufacturers have stated that there will be vehicles, productionized vehicles on the road that will have autonomous capability. And if you think about it, the vehicles that are in existence even today, they have the ability to park themselves, some of the features, they have cruise control. So we have elements of autonomy already there.
But it's a big leap to take away the human element from it entirely, isn't it?
It's a challenge, and that's where Ireland can play a really strong role, because it has to be tested, it has to be validated, it has to be substantiated. And that's where the road network in Ireland, the infrastructure, and Ireland plays a leading role in understanding infrastructure at a global level. And we see markets out there already. We see New Zealand, we see the Netherlands, Australia, that equate in lots of ways to Ireland moving forward. And I think it's about getting first mover advantage, or at the very least being a fast follower in this area.
I wouldn't regard myself as a sort of technical Luddite by any means, but I don't like to use the cruise control on a car because I don't even like the idea of it. I like to be in charge and in control. Just because the technology is moving in a particular direction, does it not presuppose or forget that people like to drive cars?
For any vehicle on the road, whether it's connected, autonomous or a normal car that we have today, there's three main elements. There's the vehicle, there's the individual, and there's the infrastructure. And it's about understanding what their needs are as technology changes, and our needs will change as well. So our expectations are always changing. You know, we want information as quickly and reliably as possible. And if autonomous or connected vehicles offer a service to us that we will be willing to pay for, a value add in terms of how we live our lives, then you see people getting buy-in. And certainly people's behaviours and understanding the needs and the wants and the value that they associate that is a really important aspect in this conversation.
Richard Curran with John McCarthy, whose job description is Intelligent Mobility Leader at engineering consultancy Arup. But I leave you now with another song from Big Tom for the week that's in it. Gramagov Aswargoluther, Gideon Tachtin Shahogin, Gideshap Slon.
By the side of a clear crystal fountain, there stands a lonely churchyard closely by. There's a tombstone decorated with primroses in the memory